We were so scared of the IPO. At some point, we realized it would happen. We were so scared that it would change the company completely. So we invested a lot in building culture, making sure that the day On is a public company, that nothing would change. So I think the whole purpose work was very, very important in that. And honestly, I'm personally super proud when we're having an executive or a management meeting and we're talking about the goals that On should have in 2 years from now from a financial perspective. And some of the people are standing up and saying, like, why do we need to grow 28%? It should be 20. Like, how is it linked to the purpose? And I think that's the work that we try to do. And that's a discussion that hopefully On will keep on having.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged. Leaders Unplugged is real talk with the impactful. My name is David Bach. I'm your host. And I welcome you to a special episode recorded live at Orchestrating Winning Performance, or OWP, our biggest annual leadership program with over 500 leaders from more than 60 countries here in Lausanne. My colleague Alison Meister sat down for an on-stage chat with Marc Maurer, the outgoing co-CEO of On. On is a Swiss sportswear company that went from zero to IPO in just over a decade. You may have seen the uniquely designed shoes on Roger Federer, who is one of On's investors. You may have seen them on the starting lines of many major marathons. Or maybe you're among the millions of people wearing them every day. On is now the third most valuable publicly traded footwear brand behind Nike and Adidas. The company's sales have been growing 30% year after year. Marc shares how On avoided the traps that sink so many scale-ups, why they refused to hire anyone from the industry for a decade, said no to the metaverse, and made humility part of the business model. Oh, he also tells us why a $1 million campaign was necessary to explain the company name is On and not QC. Let's jump right in when Marc explains to Alison how he and his co-founders, all inexperienced in shoe design, came up with their first shoe.
So the technology was innovated actually by an ETH engineer.
Okay.
And he was doing that together with Olivier Bernhardt, who is one of the founders. He was a professional triathlete and he had problems with his Achilles. So he couldn't run anymore. And the ETH engineer used him as a test case almost on how to have a cushioning technology that would minimize basically the impact on your joints and muscles. That was how the technology came about. And now the question was, what would this shoe need to look like? We had many different designers pitching, and they all made a shoe that looked like a shoe. And then we had another designer pitching who was doing some work with Swatch as well. He had no clue about shoes, and he made a shoe that looked like an On. And so I think we went for that one because it was important to really be differentiated versus what the other players would be doing out there, because otherwise you would never spot the product on the wall.
So I just think it's fascinating the role of not having experience in something to create, you know, absolutely new innovation. And building on that, you said that you're already creating products for 2028 right now. And your initial shoe came from really listening to the problems that Olivier had in his running experience and triathlete experience. How do you stay close to what the customer needs and wants, or how do you project what a customer is going to need in 2028?
That is a very good question and a very big challenge.
Yeah.
Right? So I think in the end, we're creating a product that is made for a certain consumer. It's authenticated by an individual that might inspire you. It's authenticated by a marketing story that we tell. But our job is to know kind of what brings you a better running or movement experience. And in the end, you know, what makes you move more, because that's in the end the purpose of the company. So I think we're trying to stay very, very close to the consumers. I think we co-develop a lot with our athletes, for example. We try to go into new consumer segments where we're not in through collaborations. This is where a partnership with Loewe comes in. So I think it takes a lot of humbleness and kind of close to that consumer to really make sure you're hearing the people you're trying to serve. The challenge, I think, for many different companies, as they become more successful and as they become bigger, I think they become more introvert in how they look at the consumer. So at some point, you start to think how amazing you are, and you basically look at the product yourself and you think, well, how amazing what I created, but you don't really realize that no one wants that anymore. And so I think with the success that On is seeing, how can On keep on being extrovert or at least humble and listen to our consumers and make sure we're creating product that helps you to move in a better way. But I think it's a big, big challenge. Like when you look at many of our competitors, at some point you hit a ceiling for many different reasons, but one is because you're becoming very, very introvert as a company with success.
As you get bigger, you become really more self-oriented, a little bit sure of ourselves. So staying humble, that's a word that you mentioned. Staying humble, staying curious about the customer and having that empathy to really understand what they need. And I like that you said that you co-design as well with athletes. I noticed on the website and how you present, you have lots of partnerships with athletes around the world from so many different sports, Roger Federer one. You call them members of your team. What does that mean? Do they come in? Do they work with you on products? Do they have shares in the company? How does it work with the athletes you work with?
So all of it, depending on the athlete. When we looked at athletes, I think for many years, or what many other companies do, we feel they're basically putting a logo on a chest. And so you're almost taking that human almost as a subject. You put a logo on a chest, and as long as that person is successful, you have your logo running out there. But you don't really care about the human being. So what we did very, very early on, we basically created a program with the athletes where they would get health insurance. So you have a huge topic, for example, with female athletes after pregnancy that they're just getting dropped by the brands. We're not doing that. We actually took a lot of athletes or mothers from other brands to then join on. And you know, we signed them during pregnancy. We do career advice, which is a big topic. So we're really trying to treat them as part of the team, because for us, they are, right? They are our biggest ambassadors out there. And it's not just about a logo. It's about how do we tell stories together? It's about how do they identify with On? You know, you saw Ben Shelton kind of in the video playing. Many of them are personal friends and we create product together. We're listening to them and say, Ben, what do you want to look like in Wimbledon? You know, what do you want to wear next year for the Australian Open? And the more time they give us, the better, because they are the power users of the product. So they know much better than we do on what we need to change. And then we're trying to make the change. So I think it's a very, very, very close relationship.
Yeah, it really shows the value of being very close to your customers. And I think across all industries, sometimes you can feel really detached. And that process of staying close to who it is something that needs to be embedded in the culture. And I think that's, you're a really great example of how to do that. And so one of the questions I have, you've grown exponentially, right? 70% year on year in the first 10 years, then you IPO, then it's 30% per year on around 28, 25. How do you keep the pace of growth up? Is there kind of a plateau that you project at some point? And then how do you communicate that, if so?
It's actually a fine line. So I use this picture a lot of you're the captain of a sailing boat, or you have your sailing boat, and you need to sail your boat like super hard in the wind if you want to win, but just to the amount it doesn't, how does it capsize, right?
Yeah.
So, and that is a very fine line. And I think you're trying to ride this fine line, and sometimes you overstep a bit, that you realize when, you know, products are late, when the quality is where it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're hitting the line. So I think this was often a dialogue with our team as well, in a sense of, hey, what do we feel? How much growth can the company really absorb? How much growth is customer expecting from us? There is just, if you look at Asia Pacific right now, that region is still growing above 100%. Wow. And people want to get access to the products. Now, we could put 80 stores in China just this year. We could. Question is, would we have the right location? Would we have the right team that serves you in a good way? Would we have all the product available? And so I think you're trying to find that line. It's very hard operationally, because at some point we're not a tech company, right? So we're actually producing physical goods. There was a time, I think 21, we added the same amount of revenue as Nike did in that year. But we added it on a basis of 500 million and they added it on a basis of 40 billion. Mm-hmm. And what that does for the supply chain is crazy, right? Yeah. And so I think it's very, very hard work. It's a fine line. And we're having conversations with the team where the team is challenging us and saying, why do we actually want to grow? Mm-hmm. Like, why?
When's enough enough?
When's enough enough? Yeah. Like, why 28%? Why not 20%. Mm-hmm. Who tells you it should be 28? Who tells you it should be 20? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to have that dialogue and you know, for every company to be able to have that dialogue. And for us, it was important that we have a say in that dialogue. And I think that's the difficult one as a public company. You have the short-term thinking, which I don't think On has, but then you have basically just the logic of the capital markets, because they're going to put the valuation of your company and you exactly know what numbers you need to tell them that you're going to achieve in 2 years from now in order to justify the number that's there. Mm-hmm. And so that's a dialogue you need to have with the team and say, okay, if we go a bit higher, can we really achieve it? If we go lower, are you okay to take the impact that we will have on our valuation as a company? And I think as a public company, that's an important dialogue to have, and we try to have that.
Have that with the investors, right? Really, as well.
Have it with the team first. Yeah. And then I think the team needs to say, okay, this is what we stand for. Mm-hmm. And then we go to the investor and say, look, this is what you can expect from us. And then we try to hit it.
Yeah, I think that's always one of the biggest challenges. How did you structure the IPO? So, you know, I think it's an interesting kind of strategy for the IPO. So you have a bit more balance and you have a little bit more control over some of these big questions.
In the IPO process, we actually created voting shares, which mm-hmm. is something that is very normal in the US with tech companies, which was an absolute no-go in Switzerland with some of our investors from a corporate governance perspective. But in the end, I think many investors invested in On because of the team, because of the product. And I think it was important to everyone who was involved that if we go public, that in that case, the five of us could continue to decide how we want to steer On from a long-term perspective. So we created basically voting shares, which are still in place, I think, which are very, very important for long-term thinking. What it doesn't change is you still have a public valuation, right? So we spoke about some private companies like Lego. They are not in the public market. Yeah. So they don't have a daily ticker that tells you, today you're worth this, tomorrow you're worth this. So I think you are, even if you have a voting share structure, you're way freer in your decision-making if you stay a private company.
Yeah.
Being public has other advantages. On would not be where it is today without being a public company. Mm-hmm. But it also brings like things that just change the discussion.
New dynamics, yeah. Right? In terms of growing into the future then, knowing that, okay, maybe there is a point where enough is enough, what do you see as the biggest growth areas that On might move into? You know, knowing that you're going to be leaving, but where can you project? Is it new shoe lines, new sports, new apparel, technologies? Where do you see the growth? The geographies?
So we still have a lot of room to grow internationally.
Yeah.
So On still has a lot of potential. Southeast Asia, Asia in general, China, just starting in Korea, for example, a huge market. The US still has potential. Many European markets still have potential, relatively small in France, relatively small in Italy. So I think there's geographical growth potential. There is new sports that you could potentially go in. On is not in football, for example. So there could be sports where you go in. Apparel is still very, very small. So if you look at the absolute revenue number and you look at some of the big apparel players, On has a lot of opportunity to grow. Mm-hmm. And then the whole direct channel is just getting started. So we only started retail in 2021. And so obviously that gives you an outsized revenue because you have the full kind of margin from the product mm-hmm. versus a wholesale partner where you basically distribute it at half the price to the wholesale partner.
When you were starting and when you were growing and you know that exciting phase, did you look to any other organizations as role models? And were they in your industry or were they out of your industry? Who were your organizational role models at the time?
Both. I think we looked at many different companies and many different companies inspired us in different ways. So the very original idea was that this product would be the only product that we ever create. That was kind of the iPhone mm-hmm. idea, right? So it was like, okay, why have all these different products? We're just going to create one shoe that does 100 of millions in revenues. That didn't work out. So we looked at the way Nike, for example, does marketing and how they use the athletes and the way Nike is able to be actually quite a premium brand in certain ways and at the same time a super discount brand, just reaching so many people. There's organizations that, you know, inspired us from how they were being led. And so I think we looked at a lot of different organizations. In the beginning, we never hired from our industry. That only started way later. For the first 10 years, it was forbidden to hire from a competitor. Almost.
Really?
Almost. Not in every function, like sourcing and so on, you needed to have it.
Yeah.
But we would never hire a marketing person from Nike in the first years. Never.
You wouldn't? So nobody from Adidas, nobody from Nike never. In the first years. No. Why?
Because we felt in many industries, you basically have a cycle of people moving just from one company, because this is what your core capability is, right? So usually if we get applications from Nike, you could be sure that person was at Adidas before. And so why would that person basically be able to create something different if you've learned from those two organizations? Oh. And I think we needed to create our own DNA and our own innovation journey early on. Now it's a bit different because we have huge teams that work on product, and you know, Adidas and Nike and some of our fellow kind of brands have done an amazing job in educating those people. But in the early days, it was important for us to create our own DNA.
Such a cool that, for imagine for the first 10 years, not hiring anyone who's from your actual industry.
Maybe it was more like 8 years.
Yeah, eight years. But
it's not about the years.
Yeah, it's not about the, you know, don't quote him on that. You know? But it is, I think it's a fascinating mindset. If you get to the mindset of that, because often we look for, the first thing we look for on a resume is, do they have experience in this industry, right? And they're looking for, do you not have experience in this industry? Probably disappointed a lot of applicants at the time as well. Last question on kind of the business, because I really want to get into the dive deeper into that culture. What has been the hardest kind of choice as you grow and you innovate and there's so much demand for your products? What have been some of the choices and trade-offs you've had to make when it comes to sustainability?
I think the on sustainability, probably the biggest trade-off is still perceived product performance versus sustainability. So let's take tights as an example. Mm-hmm. Are you able to compromise on some of the fibers that go into your product that are less sustainable for the tights to feel better? And so there is still a trade-off basically in playing that. And you know, if you don't compromise or if you are not compromising on it, your sales will be less. Because you know some of the other brands are putting stuff in there that mm-hmm. just stretches the product a little bit more, and On will not be able to do that. So I think the biggest kind of trade-offs are really on the product, but not from a cost perspective for us. Mm-hmm. It was really about the consumer promise that we're able to give. And then I think for this industry, the holy grail is circularity. So in the end, the whole industry needs to be able to move to a product where you can reuse all its materials by taking it apart, by basically decomposing, you know, kind of, or putting it back into its elements and by reusing a lot of the product. For that, you need to be able to take a product back, which almost no one is doing. H&M is a worthwhile, exceptional example there. You need to have the chemical and mechanical recycling facilities in place, which are not in place. You need to make sure everything that goes into your product can be reused. So I think it's a huge journey and a huge challenge for the industry.
No, I think it is a huge journey and challenge for many, many industries. And sticking to it in times like these, where we see you know, waning motivation and these trade-offs become even more potent and even more public.
So we had basically a summit that was orchestrated by MIT, by a collective that's called the Footwear Collective. And the idea was to bring 15 CEOs of the industry together. And roughly 1 month ago, I think 12 canceled because, you know, now customs and taxes and the trade war was the topic of the day.
Yeah.
As if this would change our view on sustainability, right? But I think everyone just has a certain set of attention. And unfortunately, right now, it feels to me the topic is being deprioritized by a lot of executives. And I hope the world and all of us in here get back into a place where we can make it a focus independent of what's going on in the world. Because that's not a one-year question, that's a 30-year question. Yeah. And we need to continue to work on it.
And I think it's not either or, it's both and. Right? Like, how do we fight the fires of today that we need to fight, yet create the future that we want to have in the future? Yeah. And sometimes it's seen as a trade-off instead of, you know, a paradox of both and that we can handle. And I think actually moving, you know, building on that, moving into On's purpose, you've done before the IPO, you did a lot of work on the purpose of the organization and the mission that I heard was talked about in the video. What is the purpose or mission of On, and how did you come to it, and how does it play out at work?
So the purpose of On is igniting the human spirit through movement. And basically, it really comes from a place that we personally experienced, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens with your brain when you move? Like, movement is not just important for your body, it's extremely important for your brain. And at On, like, very often, we actually don't have discussions in a meeting room. We go on walks. We always walked, right?
Yeah.
So, except today we sat because it was too hot.
We walked. My Canadian blood doesn't work in this heat.
So, walking stimulates something in your brain, right? And it allows you to think more creatively about solutions versus just sitting in a room. And we really felt, hey, look, if humankind can continue to come up with amazing ideas, movement is very, very important. And we want to create products and stories that basically inspire you to move. And with that, they ignite your human spirit. And we were so scared of the IPO. At some point, we realized it would happen. We were so scared that it would change the company completely. Mm-hmm. So we invested a lot in building culture, making sure that the day On is a public company, that nothing would change. So I think the whole purpose work was very, very important in that. And honestly, I'm personally super proud when we're having an executive or a management meeting and we're talking about the goals that On should have in 2 years from now from a financial perspective. Wow. And some of the people are standing up and saying, like, why do we need to grow 28%. It should be 20. Mm-hmm. Like, how is it linked to the purpose? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the work that we try to do. And that's a discussion that hopefully On will keep on having.
I think that's the ideal, right? When the purpose of the organization actually translates into strategic choices, it's not just a line in the website. And I think I heard through an interview at one point with, I think it was Martin, he said, actually, our purpose, igniting the human spirit through movement, actually has made us not invest in going into the metaverse, for example, like Nike. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I can tell you, that was an interesting episode. So that whole topic of metaverse came up, and we have some people in our team who are always at the forefront of technology. And, you know, immediately we would get together as like, we need to invest in the metaverse. We tried to understand everything. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg started to call whatever Facebook Meta and so on. So it was the thing. And we spent hours talking about it. And then at some point, Alex Griffin, who is the CMO, he said, we're actually the anti-metaverse.
The anti-metaverse.
That was like, we are real, you know, it's about movement. Yeah. And so that was really where, in the end, the answer was lying in our purpose. Yeah. And that moment, it was not like a business opportunity discussion or whatever. Everyone's like, yeah, we need like digital, whatever they had, you know, they have their product in this metaverse and you can buy it, but actually never wear it. And and maybe that works, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. Yeah. But it was clear with our purpose, it doesn't make sense to do that. So this is how we became the anti-metaverse.
I like it, the anti-metaverse. But I think it's a fascinating example of how purpose can drive strategic choices. It doesn't have to just be, you know, a statement. It actually can help you hone in your strategy and litmus test whether we're making the right decisions. And I think you recently, or I'm not sure how recent it is, but I think this igniting the human spirit through movement, you're bringing this to new populations around the world. And you have a new initiative called Right to Run, or maybe it's not super new.
Not super new.
But yeah. I found it fascinating. Yeah. And, you know, how does that tie in to motivate employees around this purpose?
So we are all in the fortunate position that I think most of us actually have the financial means to buy the products. And most of us are living in an environment where you're allowed to move. You can move. There's a lot of people who don't have that opportunity. Movement is not something that we take it as a given, but it's not a given for many, many people. So when we thought about how can On kind of have an impact beyond the core of what we're doing, we had very, very long discussions around it. Also, like, what should go into sustainability? Is that actually impact? Or is that a good cause? Or is this just core of the business of what we're doing? And so again, this brought us back to the purpose. We said, hey, look, what we need to do with part of our profit is we need to make sure people move that otherwise couldn't move. So we created Right to Run, which basically supports organizations that are helping people to move that otherwise couldn't. I give you two examples. So one very successful one is in the US at the West Coast. There is a person who had drug addiction and who basically took a lot of people who were willing to get out of fentanyl and so on, and to get them to movement. So we supported him, and now it's hundreds of people. They have the programs, but those are not structured around movement usually, mm-hmm. and they're bringing the movement part in. Mm-hmm. And if you see people who have been, you know, lying on the street, close to death, and then they rediscover walking, just walking, they can't run. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very beautiful. And without him, that wouldn't happen. We're also supporting an organization called Klabu. I'm doing a lot of work there. I will do a lot of work there post on. So please check out klabu.org. What they're doing is they're basically bringing sports to the refugee camps of this world. So you have millions of people living in refugee camps. Mm-hmm. They will never leave those. They're basically creating containers that they're shipping there, and they're doing a programming so that the people could meet at the central point. They're educating teachers how to teach football, how to teach badminton, how to teach running. So, you know, it becomes this flywheel of more and more people going there and being able to move. That's two initiatives that Right to Run is supporting, yeah. and there's many more.
And not only does that help you achieve the purpose externally, but I'm sure it motivates
a huge piece
employees in the organization yes. to see the impact of what they're doing.
Everyone has to do a voluntary day every single year.
Okay.
Every year, like one voluntary day. And, you know, usually the team partners up with some of those organizations.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a lot of voluntary days.
A lot of voluntary days.
And so can you tell me, so the human spirit through movement, actually spirits are how you define your culture at the organization. Can you tell me about the spirits that kind of embody the organization and maybe your some of the ones that you think are most the most prominent ones?
Basically, the purpose is the why, right? And so you have the company purpose and you have your own purpose, which is your personal why. That might be slightly different than the company purpose, but ideally it aligns. The spirits, which most other companies call the values, is probably a bit more the how. And they are very, very important because I think in many cases, there's no right or wrong in decision making. So if I look back at the last 13 years, there were very few decisions that we took or that I took where it was clear cut. Mm-hmm. And so when you don't know what to do, it actually helps to go back to some of those values or spirits. And so one that I can point out, which is probably very specific to On, is what we call the explorer spirit, mm-hmm. which goes to the entrepreneurship of the company. So everyone should be an explorer, and everyone is empowered to be an explorer. So if you're not sure if you should do it, do it. If you fail, great.
So you embrace failure.
Totally.
I think one of the challenges of bigger organizations can be sometimes that failure can feel very scary.
Yeah.
And that all comes down to kind of the psychological safety in the organization. How would you say you build the culture at On? Like, how is it, Chrissy, you've got these five spirits. There's explorer spirit. There's athlete spirit, which is around pushing yourself. There's around team spirit. What are some of the other ones?
Survivor spirit.
Survivor. What does survivor spirit mean?
Survivor spirit is basically the sustainability part of it.
Got it. And how do you create that culture and keep it when you're growing so fast? Like, how do you bring people into it and make sure they live it?
I think first it starts with the picture of the company that you're creating, because that attracts people. How do we attract people in the whole recruiting process, and how do we onboard people that we feel are living the culture? So for actually more or less, I think the first 500 employees, the five of us interviewed personally. Like for a very long time, we interviewed all the people. So I think kind of the selection of the team members is a huge part. Then I think we try to do a lot of systemic work. So how do you create a culture that is less dependent on individuals? And so when I leave, the culture needs to remain the same. Mm-hmm. Or it can change. If we want it to be better, it continues to evolve. But the moment I leave and the culture falls apart, I didn't do a good job at building a culture that is systemic, mm-hmm. right? So we had a lot of initiatives to build that systemic culture. And so be it as part of onboarding, be it as part of when we speak. Mm-hmm. So when we speak in front of the company, we always go into the same topics again and again and again. 80% of my speaking time is about culture.
Really?
Like, goals and strategic initiatives takes maximum 20%. 80% is culture. And it's the same message again and again and again. And then it's the team and the leadership. So most people have relatively little exposure to the CEO or the executives team of the company. So the question is, the people that impact the organization the most, how do you make sure they live and breathe the culture that the organization wants to have? And so it's, I think it's a mix of many, many different things.
It's really important. So we call those culture carriers, right? Finding those people in the organization that live and breathe the culture and infect everybody else with it. And you're talking about training those leaders, training that team to really be a reflection of who we want to be and hire for it. One thing I think really cool about On, what's the average age of employees at On across the whole business?
I think it has evolved now, but it's probably 33 right now. Or
33,
something.
The average age in the company. And so,
which means we have no clue.
Exactly. And so really, I think that kind of embodies some of the culture. It's very youthful. Do you notice, I guess you're at On, so maybe it's different, but in, compared to, you know, other company cultures, one of the questions that comes up a lot in classes, how do we harness and motivate that Gen Z employee, the younger employees? What would you say is the secret that keeps you able to do that?
One thing I really like about that generation and how it has impacted On and us is that purpose is very important to them. And so they're actually whole, I don't need to go into the organization and say we need to do sustainability. The team will come to us and say, why are we not doing more on sustainability? Yeah. You know, why are we not doing more on diversity and inclusion? And so I think to make sure that everyone is heard and making sure that we're openly discussing the topics is very, very important. And I think On is doing a pretty decent job on making sure that is happening.
And you're right. A recent study by Deloitte that just came out on looking at millennials and Gen Z's purpose is hugely important. Working for a company where they feel they're living their values, having a sense of meaning to what they do, it really attracts and retains people. I'm trying to get in some of these questions as we go. Let's move to a few personal questions. And I see some coming up, so I'm going to pull on them too. First of all, you were co-CEO. Would you be co-CEO again? Why or why not?
Totally.
Yes.
I think it's very rewarding to do it together with a partner. I think you can bounce off ideas, but for me, it's never been about like just the two of us. In the end, it's the team that built the company, and our job was to allow the team to be successful, to steer them, to help them. And, you know, the team gave Martin and I the permission to have that role, and it was amazing, and I really appreciate it.
What makes it work? What made it work? What do you think you did? Were there rituals or practices you engaged in to make it work?
To put it very simple, I think Martin's role was to make me successful and my role was to make Martin successful. Mm-hmm. And I think this is when it works and when you have complementary skills. Martin and I are very different. You know both of us.
Yeah.
We're very different. But we're getting along extremely well and we respect each other. I think in many, many cases it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
I think the moment you got to serve the purpose and you got to serve the other person, the moment you serve yourself, it will not work.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fascinating. When you work together, how did you resolve disagreements or different ways of seeing the same thing? Because you are very different. That means you would have different approaches to the same problem. How did you decide in the end?
Walking and talking. We speak like we spoke every day, every day. And and sometimes, you know, it doesn't feel good and you feel it in your body, you feel it in your stomach and you're like, Martin. And that's the moment you need to call, right? And not the moment you need to go to someone else and say, oh my God, Martin.
Yeah.
And so I think that was very important for us. The moment it felt like something, you got to approach the person. And that's not just me, Martin. I think that's overall in the organization. With everyone who's part of On, the moment something doesn't feel right, you got to call the person.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It takes courage. It's uncomfortable.
To have that conversation.
But it's the only way.
Works in relationships too. Have the conversation. Many people are asking, why are you making the decision to go? What's next? And, you know, where are you right now? What do you see for the future?
So for me, that was a decision that was in the making for like a year. Probably within my mind, and obviously kind of On being a public company, it has to come as a surprise to everyone. But it was also a big compliment that it was a surprise because it probably meant that I was really involved till the moment it got announced. I think the last 15 years were unbelievably beautiful and unbelievably intense. And I think On is evolving as an organization, I'm evolving as an individual, and I just looked at, hey, okay, what will the next 15 years at On look like? What drives me? What motivates me? What gives me energy? What takes energy? And kind of after careful dialogue with myself, I decided that I want to try to have a next chapter,
yeah,
which I'm not going to share in here.
Not publicly and, yet.
Exactly.
I'll keep pushing.
But definitely before that happens, just take some time to breathe. I look at a lot of executives in the world and I ask myself, how can someone actually do that for 15 years? Like, it's mm-hmm. crazy because it's so intense and kind of, you know, personal health and being able to recharge, being able to be my personal best every single day. You know, I felt I owe that to the team. That takes time to recharge. So the next months are definitely fully focused on family and kids and getting some me time.
Yeah, yeah.
No more IMD speeches.
Aren't we privileged to be the last to kind of talk as CEO? We're so honored to have you here. And so I think at this point, there's one question that keeps coming up. Where did the name On come from? How was the company named?
Company was actually first named Neon.
Neon? Really?
It was named On.
I didn't know that.
And the reason it was named On is because when you stood into the product, we felt like you're being switched on. So because what the technology does, it kind of works your lower back muscles because the product has a certain instability. Not making that up, it's actually true. You stand in the product way more straight than you would stand in other products because the product doesn't provide you the support that others do. So you had that instability, puts you straight, and so it felt like you're being switched on, and like that thing that you see on the O
is the
little tick, that's the switch.
Uh-huh.
Problem is,
mystery solved.
I'm not sure that was the smartest idea ever because 80% of the population thinks it's called QC, which led us to do a Super Bowl ad with Roger Federer.
Oh, wow.
And where basically, you know, he was explaining that it's called On and not QC. So cost us a couple million dollars to put that right, but
yeah,
hopefully it sticks.
Super Bowl is not cheap, not cheap. And I'm sure Federer isn't either. So that is another question that came up. Why Federer?
I think he is an outstanding individual. And for us, it was a privilege to be able to start to have the dialogue with him. We were super inspired by him for what he has achieved, for how he shows up as an individual. And we wanted to go into tennis.
Yeah.
And I think we needed authenticity to go into tennis. I don't think a brand can go in there without having a reason to be, right? Yeah. And so the reason was Roger. And somehow we convinced him to come to our offices. And then there was a dinner and then there was another dinner and another dinner. And I think it worked out pretty well for everyone involved. So
is he as calm and cool in person as he comes
very,
off?
Very calm and cool. No, he's a really, really great individual. And it's been real fun really to work with him on product and see his perspective, learn from him, and maybe he learned a thing or two from us. So it's a very, very nice partnership.
Yeah, he seems to embody the spirit.
Totally.
So I would say a good choice. So we have very little time left, and I know you have a very nice dinner to get to tonight, but I wanted to do a bit of a lightning round. I've got 10 lightning round questions. So in 10 seconds or less, you have to answer these questions.
How many can I skip?
We'll see exactly. So I'm just going to ask a bunch of random questions and see how he does. Number one, what's the first thing you eat in the morning?
I drink a coffee.
Coffee. All right. Check.
I don't eat in the morning.
You don't eat in the morning?
I know it's not best practice.
No. I mean, we can go well into that too. Number two, what is one word your kids would use to describe you?
Love.
Oh, that's nice. What is number three? What is your favorite band?
Right now it's Oasis because I'm going to their concert in Wembley and I'm not sure if they're still, it's their second concert since they're back and I'm not sure they'll actually be giving it or they have a fallout before.
Yeah, exactly. We'll find out. Number four, who's your favorite athlete?
I don't have a favorite athlete. There's many who I really, I appreciate athletes. Don't have a favorite.
Right. Number five, what is a guilty pleasure that you have?
why would I share that with you? We're like, we have way to go.
Number six, is there any show that you've binge watched?
I'm not binge watching shows.
Oh,
no, absolutely not.
Either have I, you know. Number seven, did you have a nickname as a child?
Oh, it's Maggie. It's very Swiss.
So. Maggie?
Maggie.
Maggie. Yeah. What does that mean?
It's just a very weird version of my actual name.
So. Cute.
Very cute.
Number eight, what is a book that has influenced you?
Many, not a single one right now. I think over the last years, probably one of the writers that influenced me most is Arthur C. Brooks.
Arthur C. Brooks.
Yes.
All right. Number nine, what is a habit that keeps you grounded to manage stress?
Movement, running.
Running.
Tennis, whatever.
That makes sense. Number 10, what is your favorite On shoe ever?
Depends on the movement pattern. There's not one, but I love our professional tennis product because I'm playing more tennis now. And I love the light spray product.
The light spray.
Like the very fast marathons and fast races.
Thank you very much for the light spray. That was the 10 questions. That light spray, you literally spray a shoe on people.
No, yeah. You spray it on a last.
To spray on a last, okay.
But then you put it on your foot afterwards.
So they just, and that creates the product.
Yeah.
Crazy. Fascinating. Check it out online. It's super cool. It's a really next level, interesting innovation. All right. Well, on that note, I want to say a huge, huge thank you from all of us for coming today.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I have. Leaders Unplugged will be back in a few days with my conversation with Daniel Ziblatt, Harvard political scientist and author of the best-selling book, How Democracies Die. Leaders Unplugged is a co-production of IMD and Remote Daily. This episode was produced by Allison Meister, Frank Taboring, Delia Fischer, Felix Zeltner, and Rabea Debus. If this episode sparked new thinking for you, please share it and subscribe to Leaders Unplugged on your favorite podcast platform.